It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Speaker's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence is set to hold a public hearing Wednesday. The committee is studying the role of AI in elections, in business, government, other facets of life. And you can call in with a question, share comments at any point at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nate Gustafson is a Republican representing Assembly District 55, includes Nina, and chairs this AI task force. Representative Gustafson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So in August, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss forms this AI task force. How will the task force develop legislation and policy recommendations to address AI?
Yeah, so putting together this task force, my number one goal has been about education. A lot of times when we hear AI, we kind of have a runaway thought of, well, we might think of Skynet from Terminator, or we may know ChatGPT, which is a very hot topic that a lot of people like to discuss. So we really want to first and foremost educate not only the legislators, but the public on what AI really is, how it's been used in government and private sector. For the last, a lot of people don't understand that it's actually been around for about 15 years now in the capacity that people will think. So we're really just trying to educate first and foremost. And then secondly, on the backside, we want to make sure that we're putting up guardrails with kind of the ethics and the responsibility of anyone who's using AI, of, you know, making sure that we're not going far beyond our reach than we should, or putting ourselves in a jeopardizing spot as a society.
Can you explain a bit more your discovery process that you anticipate, the steps to understanding how AI is used in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So we actually have reached out to quite a few stakeholders that have been developing or working with AI over the last couple decades, including Google, Microsoft from the private sector, as well as we're looking at getting some of the public sector input as well, DOJ, maybe some crimes that they've seen that they've had to investigate that were conducted via AI-generated technology. So ultimately, we're trying to reach out to everyone who's anyone who wants to come and speak on AI, give us their input on it, both, again, people from the field expertise, as well as regular, you know, citizens across the state of Wisconsin that are willing to come and just voice their opinion on this.
When you announced overseeing the task force, you used AI to help write your press release. You said it there at the bottom. How else are you using AI in your work as a lawmaker?
So that was just kind of the little fun play with with what we have. So I thought I'd catch some eyes. But in general, that's the only way I've used it so far. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a trend in the future of individuals using AI to generate statements like that, not just legislators, but also companies. Or I've actually seen to the extent that social influencers have been generating certain content that they put out, which, you know, kind of puts you in this weird spot of who's saying what and is it really them saying it? So that's going to be one of the things we look at as we go forward with this task force.
But I'm thinking all of the outreach from constituents who are contacting lawmakers for a variety of different reasons. Do you see any role AI there in connecting with constituents and their concerns?
I could see an opportunity where we may have a system where if constituents are reaching out, it may get almost streamlined, where it's easier to just have who's reaching out, what they're reaching out about, and then having the representative be able to interpret, obviously, the mass influx of constituent outreach. So obviously, if there's a hot issue, we can, you know, AI might be able to smartly put it together in a way that's easily digestible for a legislator to go, oh, well, the public is against this issue, or they're strongly in support of this issue. We could see a lot of that. The other factor that we could see a lot more of is AI being used in other entities, other agencies within the state that may help speed up the process. I know one area that we've been kind of looking at just briefly so far is the Department of Professional Services and Safety, which has been regulatory with licensure. So If someone's having an issue with the process with getting their licensure, is there some system that someone can reach out to that is AI driven that goes, hey, where's my process? Where's the process at with my licensure? So stuff like that. We're trying to think outside the box. We're not trying to stifle innovation when it comes to AI and where we can use it, but we also want to make sure we're just being responsible when we're implementing it.
We're talking about this new task force to address AI in Wisconsin. With its chair, we have Representative Nate Gustafson of NENA. You can join in with your question and your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. This year, lawmakers in at least 25 states have introduced artificial intelligence bills, and in 15 states, legislation or policy has been adopted. That's from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Is Wisconsin behind the curve, behind other states in addressing AI?
I wouldn't say we're behind the curve. I think we're right on the edge with everyone else, with AI kind of being this emerging technology that we're really still trying to grapple with what it is and what its capabilities are. I think we're in the right spot at the right time to address this with legislation in Wisconsin. So I don't think we're behind at all. I think there's some innovative ideas that have been put out by these states already, but I think we'll be looking at those as well as we go forward in our task force.
But isn't it tricky, though, to strike a balance between putting up guardrails that you talked about, some limitations on AI, but still embracing technology to make, you know, to make an industry or to make state government more responsive?
Absolutely. It's going to be this very, very tight rope that we have to walk to make sure that, again, we're not trying to say that you can't use AI, or that, you know, the development of new processes with AI are going to be forbidden. But we also need to make sure that we're not creating something that's going to, completely destroy the way of life that we have today.
Turning to business here, Rockwell Automation, Milwaukee-based $32 billion company that offers AI products for manufacturers. And earlier this year, a company executive downplayed concerns that AI would replace manufacturing jobs. Do you agree with that viewpoint?
I think currently in our current spot, I don't think it would be a concern. I think when we look at this right now, a lot of people need to understand there's three types of AI, and this is where I'm going to get a little bit of the weeds. Hopefully I can pull it back for you. So you have your artificial narrow intelligence, your artificial general intelligence, and your artificial super intelligence. Right now we're at the ANI stage, where any sort of automation that we are putting out, such as what I would assume where Rockwell would be as well, is something that a human is capable of doing, but it's not to the point of replacing a human of doing it. So it's more of to be kind of an assistant to humans as they do their jobs rather than replacing them. So I think right now we're at a spot where I don't think that would be a concern.
Governor Evers also recently announced an AI task force focusing on workforce issues. Will these two groups work together?
I am more than open to hear obviously any ideas from any spot that's willing to share in this conversation. So we'll be listening closely. We'll be trying to collaborate where we can as this process goes forward.
So do you see some overlaps in what, you know, kind of a mere committee work would be doing on AI?
There may be a little bit, but I think we have a little bit more of a broader scope of what we're looking at. So in general, again, we're looking more on the private sector side, whereas I feel the governor's task force might be a little bit more on the public sector. So overall, we're just trying to put AI within a reasonable, you know, confinement, but also letting it flourish as it continues to be developed.
Republican State Representative Nate Gustafson with us of NENA chairs the Speaker's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share your thoughts on AI. The number is 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the chair of the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence, Republican Nate Gustafson of NINA leads a bipartisan committee gathering information that could inform AI-related policies and practices in the state. And you can join the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wisconsin Watch is reporting that Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson of Beloit is drafting a bill that would mandate disclosure of AI in political ads. So looking at the political realm here, how important is regulating AI in political campaigns?
I think it's going to be critical. When people think of their representatives, they want to hear what their representatives are saying and what they're putting out. I applaud Representative Clinton Anderson for this legislation. It's definitely going to be a topic within our task force. I know he's actually on my task force with me, so I'm excited. Someone is as eager as him is on this task force that has already brought this idea forward. And I think we're going to have a lot of areas that we're going to look at when it comes to politics and elections and anything regarding that is based off AI, especially. Deep fakes is usually the big one a lot of folks hear about, is where someone may be scanned in saying something based off of, you know, clips that someone took and made AI generated, so it looks like the actual person saying it, but really it's not. So we really want to be careful. Again, it's always about trying to be the most ethical when it comes to implementing AI. And I think the bill that was presented by Rep. Anderson is going to be a good start.
Are you concerned about people impersonating other people and that type of those type of images and sound on social media?
1,000%. I have already seen it ramp up for the next election cycle, though it's usually typically higher profile individuals like presidential candidates. But I think it can be kind of the platform that will start kind of the ball rolling that will trickle down all the way to state races, local races, and we really just need to keep a kind of a beat on it obviously don't let it run away. So
yeah, the Brennan Center for Justice is concerned about AI being used in election interference and campaign disinformation. And so are you concerned about the growth of AI affecting Wisconsin's upcoming elections in 2024?
I think it's a valid concern to have. That's where it's really critical right now for us in this task force to come together, find ideas that will help mitigate a lot of the issues that we could see, such as Rep. Anderson's bill.
In April, Democratic Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a bill that would prohibit AI in election machinery, like equipment used to count ballots or to check voter identities. And Hobbs said the bill attempted to solve challenges that they do not currently face in Arizona. Should AI be prohibited in election machinery?
I think it's going to be a very, very interesting topic that will come up in the task force regarding this. I'm not 100% certain. Let me be clear. I'm not going to take a hard stance on this because I'm not sure. I'm not sure what technology is out there. I want to see folks come forward with the information that they find with this. I would be initially cautious. I would say weary of such an idea, but we always need to keep an open mind when we're looking at this kind of technology.
What is the role of AI in building or defining voter maps and legislative boundaries?
That could be a very, very interesting topic as well. I think as we go forward, we're going to have to really figure out when we're using this AI. A lot of times what people need to understand too is AI is not running on its own. It's usually human inputted or it's human developed. And so when we get to that point, we're always going to know there's going to be someone who's altering the code or putting something in, so the AI will draw from a certain database or a certain area. So ultimately, in the beginning stages, as I mentioned in the previous segment about the three parts of AI that there are, we're in that first section. And so ultimately, we're going to have to ensure that while we're using that first section of AI, that we are being responsible and trying to be as non-biased as possible. I know there's a lot of legislation also. I want to kind of pivot this for you. Of the Civil Rights Act mm-hmm. of 1964. I've seen a lot of legislation coming out to ensure that there isn't any sort of discrimination that is implemented through AI. And so that will also be a very hot topic that we look at as we go forward.
And this year, a California lawmaker introduced a bill that would prohibit discrimination through the use of automated decisions in computer code, like deciding college admissions or worker bonuses. What is your reaction to that type of legislation?
Yeah, I think all options are on the table as we move forward here in Wisconsin. We really want to make sure that obviously the best and brightest are, in a college standpoint, are getting into our colleges here without a computer determining that. So I think right now it's definitely something we'll have to look at.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just can you foresee a day there would be proposed laws to protect against unlawful discrimination, like using algorithms to, as we talked about here in college admissions, or like in setting bail or distributing welfare benefits?
Yeah, we'll have to look at all the options that are laid out for us. I think without it, without even having the conversation, would be irresponsible of us.
Talking with Republican Representative Nate Gustafson, who chairs this new AI task force, Speaker's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence, as we look at the future of AI regulation in Wisconsin and the discovery process of this committee. You can join in at any point, call in with a question, share your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So looking ahead to midweek, the task force scheduled to hold its first hearing. Agenda includes comments by representatives from Google, Adobe, and the National Conference of State Legislatures. What do you hope to learn?
We are fully opening our ears at this point to hear how private sector is using AI and how they actually interact with government as well. So we know some of them may have contracts they work with state of Wisconsin. So we're really looking to hear how they interact with us, what they feel may be ethical from their standpoint, what they've seen as potential pitfalls that we may need to try to avoid in the future. So this is going to be the kickoff on Wednesday at noon in the Capitol building in the North Hearing Room. From there, we're actually doing a roadshow. We'll have three more hearings that are going around the state, one up in Green Bay, one up in at UW-Stout, and then one more back in the Madison area. So kind of stay tuned for those. We're trying to add a little maybe motif to each one. Obviously, this week is the big kickoff, so we really just want to lay the groundwork, lay the foundation of what this task force is going out and trying to accomplish.
And can Wisconsinites get involved in these hearings? Do you want testimony from citizens?
I want testimony from anyone who has any thoughts on AI. And I hope that not only do we have these organizations that are already coming to speak, I want to hear from the constituents at the end of the day. That's who I represent, not these corporations.
I wonder, I mean, should this be up to states, or should the federal government lead the way in AI regulation? You know, how do you see this?
I think you're on the right track where a lot of our ideas are going to go. Based off of my previous research I've done even before this point, is there's a lot that we can do on a state, but there's a lot more that we can do on a federal level. So at this point, we're going to do everything within our bounds that we can as a state, but it may be laying the groundwork and foundation for federal government to pick up. So we could kind of be the trailblazers, if you will, for the federal government to come by and maybe snag some legislation that we put out and make it a federal law.
What states are you watching? What states do you have an eye on that are enacting policies around AI?
So obviously one of the biggest states is where a lot of the tech companies are, California. Mm-hmm. So they're on the forefront of it all. So definitely watching California, watching some other, we're really looking at all the states. I know there was another one that was that had defined personhood, or the what a AI is.
Oh, wasn't that North Dakota, I think?
That was North Dakota, yeah. Yes. So we're kind of looking all over the board. We're open to all ideas, but I'm thinking that there could be opportunities that we could also put something out that hasn't been heard yet in any other state. So I'm excited for that.
You know, I mean, as we've been talking here, we've gone just like all over the map in the possibilities of AI. It's changing so fast, spreading so fast across business and industry, other facets of life. Is it possible this could be like a permanent working group to address AI matters, you know, within government and industry?
From my perspective, in my opinion, let me be clear, I would love to see this be integrated into a committee that is focused on AI and emerging technologies in our state, and go forward to ensure that we are staying on top of this rather than just a one-time task force.
Well, Representative Nate Gustafson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Kate. Appreciate it.
Republican State Representative Nate Gustafson of Neenah chairs the Assembly Speaker's Task Force on Artificial Intelligence. Its first public hearing is set for this coming Wednesday at noon. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Hi, it's Kate Archer-Kent. Thank you to everyone who donated during our fall member drive. You and your community depend on Wisconsin Public Radio for independent journalism and refreshing entertainment, and its support from people like Bob and Spooner that makes this essential service possible. If you missed the drive, there is still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. And when you do, ask for your WPR belt bag for $10 a month or your WPR baseball cap for $15 a month. You play an important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. Thank you for your partnership. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to more than 200 charter schools with about 50,000 students. According to the State Department of Public Instruction, a new federal grant aims to support these schools and new ones. As we discuss charter schools, call in with the question, add your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Hackett is director of the Wisconsin Resource Center for Charter Schools. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, let's first discuss terminology, because terms like charter schools, school choice, school vouchers can be confusing. What qualifies as a charter school in terms of eligibility for federal grant funding?
Sure. So there's a couple of different things going on. So to be a charter school in the state of Wisconsin, you are a public school. You're tuition free. You are held accountable to one of the state's designated authorizers. Most of the authorizers in our state are our public school districts. And then we also have our university system and a few other identified authorizers in our statute. So all the charter schools, like I said, are public. They're tuition free, and they serve all students without any discrimination over, you know, merit or background of the student. It's all done through a lottery. So they're really, truly open for all students. In order to qualify for the federal grant, there's an additional layer where the charter school can fill out an application to the Department of Public Instruction, which is then peer reviewed from colleagues around the nation to ensure that the school is set up for success with the grant. Now, a few schools do open and expand their schools without the support of the grant, either for choice or for lack of funding, but they you don't need the grant in order to exist as a charter school, though it is incredibly helpful.
When you look at the figures, are we in a growth period? Are we plateauing on charter schools in Wisconsin or in decline? What do you see?
Yeah, I think that we are in coming up on a growth period. I would say we've had some enrollment growth over the last few years, and we also did add 75 schools over the last 6 years. Well, I shouldn't say that. There were 75 grants awarded to about 50 new schools and then some expansions. And so there are new schools starting, and there are more students enrolling. And then we're coming up on this new grant. So I anticipate increase in both enrollment and number of schools expanding during the grant. Because if you go back through our history of kind of it comes in waves. When Wisconsin has the federal grant, there tends to be some growth, and then it plateaus for a while, and then there's another federal grant. So this is an opportunity to add more seats, to add more schools, and support existing schools as well.
Are charter schools mostly in urban areas, urban districts, or do you find charter schools forming in rural Wisconsin as well?
Yes, I would say that in our history, there was a lot more charter schools in the Milwaukee area, but now that has really expanded all across the state over the last decade or two, really. I mean, we're going back now, 20 or 25 years. So there are charter schools all across the state. I keep a map on our website of all these little dots, and the dots really are spread into every region all across the state. And what's so exciting is that they are all different kinds of schools. And so that really opens up access for students everywhere in the state to be able to attend schools of all different sorts, virtual, brick and mortar, different academic models. And most are authorized by those local school districts throughout the state, but we also have a few of the independently authorized charter schools scattered around the state as well.
Why would school districts or organizations want to create a charter school?
So there's a few different reasons. I would say one of the biggest reasons that we come across is to have an innovative option in the community, in the public school setting, for students, for staff, for families who are looking for something different. And so it allows students to stay in their community, to experience learning in a different way while still meeting the same accountability measures, having access to all the same sorts of public school resources, but just the learning environment can look different. And so that's really important in our smaller communities and our rural areas of the state, so that there is some element of choice, because not all students learn the same. And so it's important to have that element of choice. And then also in our urban areas where we do see other private schools and an increase in homeschooling, an increase in open enrollment. This is a way to pull students and keep students in the public school sphere while offering that choice.
Talking with Sarah Hackett, who directs the Wisconsin Resource Center for Charter Schools, as we discuss the slate of charter schools across Wisconsin and the $58 million in federal funding for our state to expand and support charter schools. You can join in the conversation. Your questions and thoughts are welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, can you dig into a bit how will the $58 million be used?
Absolutely. So we're really excited that in a priority of the federal government in giving the funds to Wisconsin was to ensure that we were focusing on authorizing quality. And so that means that the entities like the school districts and universities and other entities that oversee the charter schools now will have access to increased support for the work that they do. And that then in turn ensures that they're only authorizing schools that are really up to caliber. They're performing, they have the oversight, they have the support that the charter school needs because they're getting it from the authorizer. So what that's going to look like is creating more partnerships with national organizations who are expert in charter school authorizing, and then creating some templates, resources, networks, one-on-one support, all sorts of different ways to ensure that the authorizers are looking at not only academics, but also the operational performance of the school and the financial performance of the school. And they're really looking at the purpose, the need for that charter school in their community. So we're also developing some really robust supports for doing community needs assessment so that the school is really only created if it truly is going to fill a need and fill it really well. And so that's one focus of what the support funds will go towards, but the majority of the 58 million, it goes directly to charter schools. So it will either go to charter schools who are replicating or expanding their existing school, and probably the majority of the applicants, at least the last time around, the majority of the applicants are schools who are going into their first year, either with a planning year or opening right up in their first year to support them with professional development, purchasing of innovative materials, and just really helping create that change in the public school space.
I imagine that first year can be a bit fragile and vulnerable as a school tries to get off the ground. I want to take a call now. Elizabeth in Verona. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, I graduated from Clark Street Community School in Middleton in 2016. They have an independent learning model, and I have seen how it has changed how I view schooling and learning, and how I just recently got my associate's degree this last spring, and how I tackled classes and stuff was directly because of Clark Street and how they helped me improve as a human being.
Elizabeth, it sounds like you made the best decision for yourself for your education. What would have happened if you hadn't made that decision?
Unfortunately, I was being bullied and I had extreme anxiety at my high school, and it was getting to the point, if nothing changed, I was afraid I was going to not be here anymore. And so Clark Street made it where I became a leader, and I had friends, and I cannot thank them enough because it made me enjoy life again.
Oh, Elizabeth, thank you so much. Please take care. Sarah, what do you hear in that story?
Oh, that's so powerful. Thank you for calling in, Elizabeth, and being so vulnerable and open. I think that Clark Street is an incredible school and one of our, district authorized charter schools that has existed for a long time and is truly a leader in innovation and thinking about how we can support our students in different environments. Sometimes it's as simple as a smaller community where students might get lost or bullied in a larger environment, but just by being in a smaller school can make so much difference. And then, like Elizabeth shared, there's also a focus on students taking ownership at Clark Street and a number of our other schools where students can really help develop their path in terms of what they want to work on, their pace, what supports they need, how they want to learn. And so some of those little tweaks, you're not changing the accountability. You're not even necessarily changing the content of the learning. You're just sort of slowing down or altering or speeding up some of those different levers that you can control within the learning environment to make truly life-changing changes for students like Elizabeth.
Sarah Hackett leads the Wisconsin Resource Center for Charter Schools as we discuss how a new federal grant will be used. And there's room for you to be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, add your views at 800-642-1234. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin receives a 5-year federal grant to strengthen charter schools and expand successful ones. The State Department of Public Instruction says this funding is Wisconsin's 7th federal grant to further public charter school development. Call in with your question, add your thoughts on this education, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Sarah Hackett with us, directs the Wisconsin Resource Center for Charter Schools. Let's take another call. Lynn in Racine. Lynn, hi. What is your question?
I was wondering, who oversees the curriculum on a charter school? Do they pick their own curriculum? Does it have to adhere to what's being taught in the public schools in that district, or are they on their own to pick what they want?
Lynn, thank you. Sarah.
Great question. So in if a charter school is authorized by a school district, for example, then the school district has to agree to what's called a charter school contract with the starting founders of the school. So the school creates what's called a governance board. It's a nonprofit board that oversees and really designs the charter school. And then they sign the contract with the authorizer. In this case, it could be with the school district. And in that contract, it really articulates what not only the design of the school is, but then how the school is held accountable. So it would articulate in there what sort of curriculum they might be using. In our state, we have a lot of schools who use the Montessori curriculum. We have schools who are using like a much more STEM, science and technology, engineering and math curriculum. We have schools who often will use a district's curriculum, but then add to it, and enhance it or somehow alter it. And so then the district is accountable to agreeing that that's an acceptable curriculum and instructional model. And so it's kind of in. It's a negotiation for each school. So there's no contract that really looks the same, but it is up to the authorizers, those public school districts, those public universities, or other entities that are entitled to authorize to ensure that the students are getting a great curriculum and instruction experience. What I will say is that charter schools also are held to some state requirements that they do not have autonomy to change. So they can kind of change the how, but they can't necessarily change the what too much. And by that, I just mean that they still have to do all the same state assessments. They have to meet the same kind of statutory requirements around graduation requirements, that in high school they're getting a certain number of credit hours in English and math and science, social studies, health, all those different requirements. So there's some things they're exempt from and then other things that they're not. And often, even if statutorily our state allows for certain exemptions, that's where the role of the authorizer is so important, and why we're going to be really stepping up our resources for those authorizers is to help them understand what are reasonable autonomies and which ones should they be really having more say over to ensure that the charter schools are doing something innovative, but still doing something that is setting the kids up for success and setting the school up for success.
Lynn, thank you so much for calling in. Turning to this recent Stanford University study found charter school students nationwide doing better in math and reading than students at other public schools, and also charter schools helping to close gaps between students of color and white students. Is there evidence that Wisconsin charters are doing better than other schools?
Well, Wisconsin is part of that Stanford study. They didn't study every state in the nation, but Wisconsin is included in those kind of lump sum findings. When I look at Wisconsin data, I would say that there is not a ton that is going to make you say aha, like it's all like, oh, a little bit higher here, a little bit lower there, but nothing that's going to push either way off the map, in either direction. So I think that where the real value of the charter schools comes in is that intentionality of design. So they can really set up a model that's going to work locally for a certain set of students. They're doing community needs assessment. They're looking at the local data. They're thinking about, who is our community? What are our community assets? How do we create a school that can be really customized and really intentional for this specific community? And then those students might do better. And sometimes, sometimes those students might still be testing similarly or having similar attendance or similar behavior that they could have had mirrored in the traditional school, but they actually are coming out ahead. They're coming out with more confidence. They're coming out with other skills. They're coming out with better mental health. So there's other measures that I think our schools look at and aim towards when doing these designs. So I would say they're not doing significantly worse, but also I can't confidently tell you that they're doing significantly better as a whole.
Sarah Hackett with us, director of the Wisconsin Resource Center for Charter Schools. As we look at the federal grant, $58 million in federal funding for Wisconsin to expand and support charter schools. And you can join in with your question and your comments at 800-642-1234. Sarah, the San Francisco-based Institute for Youth and Policy argues that charter schools, they siphon funding and star pupils away from other schools, damaging the public education system. How do you respond to that argument?
Yes, thank you. So in our state, the vast majority of our charter schools are part of our local school districts. And so it's truly up to that board and those district leaders and those business offices to really look at the finances and look at the performance and the enrollment in their charter schools and decide if it's working well for their community. And if it's not, at any time, they can choose to end that contract with the charter school. And so I would say, you know, if that were holistically true, then we wouldn't have 200 district authorized charter schools around our state. Mm-hmm. I think that very often the charter schools are an asset to that school district, retaining kids in the public schools when they otherwise may have left for homeschooling, private school vouchers, and even open enrollment to other districts. So it's really an asset, I think, to most of our local school districts who have charter schools to be able to offer those different learning environments right within their school district, and they hold them accountable financially and everything. So, yeah.
In our just few seconds we have left, what would happen to charters in Wisconsin if there wasn't this history of federal funding?
It is hard. Like you said, it's really expensive to start up with all that additional professional development and materials purchasing. And so it just makes innovation harder. And I think, you know, similar to our traditional public schools around the state, it's not that they're not innovating. They're working really hard to do professional development and infuse new materials and new training every day all across our state. But it's harder. You know, there's not specific funds set aside. There's not this additional board, the intentionality, all that stuff.
All that comes into play. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Kate, for having me and for highlighting this grant and this exciting work that our state's doing right now.
Sarah Hackett is director of the Wisconsin Resource Center for Charter Schools. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.